So I'm going to be talking about perceiving oppression. This is a work in progress paper that's part of my thesis. And let me start with an example. Experiences of sexual harassment are far from alike. So one woman might fail to even notice a catcall. Perhaps they're just quite common and have become insignificant to her, kind of like white noise in the background. Another woman might blame herself for being harassed. Perhaps her skirt was too short, her clothes were asking for it. Another woman might actually enjoy the harassment, thinking of it as a compliment for her looks, or she might dislike the harassment, but think of it as a personal problem, a simple moral wrong on the part of the harasser. All of these are what I'm going to call epistemically unhappy experiences of oppression. So they're experiences that misrepresent the world in some way, either by omitting some part of it, so this is the idea of not even noticing the catcall, or by distorting another. And why do we make such epistemically unhappy experiences of oppression? Well, feminist epistemologists have argued that oppression, social structures, injustices, and so on, influence not just how we treat one another, but they also influence our epistemic lives, how we think about one another, whom we're ready to believe. And in particular, and this will be my interest in this paper, how oppressive systems influence intuitive sense-making of situations we encounter in the world. So in the case of sexual harassment, it looks as though gender oppression in some way shapes how you're inclined to experience sexual harassment. Now, the thing I'm interested in this paper is instances where we shift from having epistemically unhappy experiences to epistemically happy experiences. So where we shift from intuitively characterizing the world in non-oppressive ways, like these examples I started with, to employing some kind of tool of sense-making that somehow reveals the oppressive nature of these social practices in question. And I'm going to use an example that might be familiar to many of you. That is the example of Kamita Wood and her cases of sexual harassment. So this is a by now classic example in philosophy that Miranda Fricker has used in her Epistemic Injustice book. And the example goes something like this. There's Kamita Wood, who's an employee at Cornell, works in a physics laboratory, and she's a plaintiff in one of the first sexual harassment court cases in 1975. Kamita Wood was routinely harassed by her boss, and at first she experienced these episodes of harassment in something like the ways I've described at the beginning. So she thought particularly that those are personal instances, a simple moral wrong on the part of the harasser. They were something she should be ashamed and embarrassed about. And they were also something that she might have perhaps been singled out for in some way. Perhaps there were some property of hers that made her be susceptible to sexual harassment. So in all these instances, these are cases of epistemically unhappy experiences, right? Wood blames herself for her particular circumstances and doesn't root the problem in the oppressive social and political conditions. But our story is about to take a happy turn. So Kamita Wood shared her experiences with other women at Cornell, and they too shared their experiences with her. And this produced an epistemic revolution. And here's a quotation from an eyewitness of that event. They all, and I quote, realized that to a person, every one of us, the women on staff, Kamita, the students, had had an experience like this at some point. And none of us had ever told anyone before. It was one of those click aha moments, a profound revelation. So I take it that this profound revelation is not just about none of them having told anyone before, or all of them having made similar experiences. Rather, the profound revelation has to do with the fact that they all come to understand that these sexual molestations aren't personal, self-inflicted, or shameful and embarrassing, but rather they form an oppressive system of sexual molestations of women by men. And this insight is due to a shift from an epistemically unhappy to an epistemically happy experience. So from seeing sexual harassment as personal and self-inflicted to seeing it as oppressive in this moment where lots of stories of sexual harassment are being shared. Now, in this paper, I'm interested in what I'm going to call an epistemic puzzle, which is essentially just the question of how these shifts from epistemically unhappy to happy experiences are possible. So if Kamita Wood deems her own sexual harassment personal and self-inflicted, and if this becomes kind of the intuitive and automatic way in which she sees the world, then it looks as though we should expect that whenever she encounters new cases of sexual harassment, either as a victim or as a witness or by a testimony, she will also interpret them in the same ways, that she will continue to think of them as personal and self-inflicted, perhaps. And then we should get to something like the following rule: when ever new encounter with sexual harassment will become an ever new epistemically unhappy experience. So new cases of sexual harassment seem to stand no chance to enlighten Kamita Wood about their oppressive nature. But, and this is where the puzzle comes in, it looks like in one encounter of sexual harassment, where lots of people shared their experience of instances like it, Kamita Wood was able to intuitively characterize it as oppressive. Okay, so then the plan for my talk today will be, in the first section, I'm going to say a bit more about this epistemic puzzle and exactly why I take it to be puzzling and where the puzzle arises from. And here, Elizabeth Camp's notion of characterizations will become relevant. Now, the story about Kamita Wood is something that Miranda Fricker is interested in for two instances, or at two points in the story. The first one is the point where Kamita Wood makes epistemically unhappy experiences, so where somehow she mischaracterizes sexual harassment, and Miranda Fricker has called this a hermeneutical injustice. And the second point Miranda Fricker is interested in is the stage where, after the story I've given you so far, they come up with the term sexual harassment. So there's a bit of conceptual innovation going on. And I'm actually interested in what happens between these two points. So something that Miranda Fricker isn't interested in the stage where discovery about oppression is made. As I said in the first bit of the talk, I'll now make the puzzle more precise. And then in the second bit, I suggest two solutions we might have to the puzzle. The first one has to do with the fact that there might be seeds of knowledge somehow pre-planted or contained in experiences of oppression. But I will reject that solution and to develop an alternative one to do with hermeneutical gaps. So Miranda Fricker, again, thinks of such gaps as somehow lacuna or gaps in available conceptual resources. So there is something we would like to express, but we lack the term or concept for it. And she thinks of such gaps then as injustices and inhibitions to knowledge. But I'm going to say that some of these gaps actually constitute opportunities for knowledge. Okay, so now onto this idea of characterizations and the epistemic puzzle. A characterization, says Elizabeth Camp, is an intuitive interpretation that perspectives produce when applied to particular situations. This definition has a lot of different moving parts in it, and I'm gonna try to make them clear as we go. But the basic idea for now is that Kamita Wood interprets her boss's sexual harassment as personal, shameful, and partly self-inflicted. And this is a kind of intuitive interpretation. So we could say she characterizes her boss's sexual harassment in this way. This idea of interpretations in Elizabeth Camp refers to sort of bundles of properties. So being personal, or being shameful is a property, and these bundles of properties might be structured in particular ways, and they might also include sort of emotion properties, so the property of being shameful, where the characterization then includes this particular property but doesn't include the emotion. Characterizations are parts of ideology, but more specific parts of ideology. This is sort of my addition to Elizabeth Camp, and this is why I'm using the notion of characterizations here rather than just speaking generally about ideological misrepresentations. Characterizations are more specific than ideology. So ideology, generally understood, we might say, is a kind of representation of social life that supports or undergirds the status quo. And this can include beliefs, but it can also include concepts, attitudes, motives, desires, values, works of art, religious gestures, religious rituals, gestures, and so on. So this is a quotation from Raymond Boyce on the handout. But the specific bit of ideology that I'm interested in is these intuitive ways of sense making. So Camp's notion of characterizations fits well. And one thing that I want to highlight is that characterizations are different from beliefs. So they need not be endorsed like beliefs. I might be able to characterize sexual harassment as being the victim's fault, for example, but that's not actually something that I believe. So my beliefs in that particular example may be better than my characterizations. But characterizations and beliefs are not entirely unrelated. So characterizations can be precursors to beliefs, for example. So when I intuitively characterize sexual harassment as my own fault, that may lead me to believe either that in this particular instance it was my own fault, or sexual harassment is typically women's own fault. And this also works for the better, more virtuous, or more accurate characterization that can also be a precursor to belief, as in the case of Kamita Wood, who then came to characterize sexual harassment as oppressive and eventually came to believe and came to know it to be oppressive. So this idea of particulars, so we've dealt with the idea of interpretations in Elizabeth Camp's definition of characterizations. Now onto the idea of a particular situation. Here we can be fairly general. So Camp says things like there can be characterizations of a quarterback or Barack Obama or an object like the Mona Lisa. And for our purposes, this means that characterizations are not only attached to particular events, but also to types. So the type of sexual harassment. And that may have a characterization, but then the particular instances, tokens of sexual harassment that we encounter in the world may also provoke an intuitive way of interpreting in us. So characterizations are then produced not only in perceptual encounters, this is the kind of paradigm case though, but they can also be produced when we process the testimony of others or when we think about or recollect sexual harassment in our case. So in the examples of epistemically unhappy experiences, Kamita would encounter sexual harassment via perception and had characterizations about it that were produced by perceptual processes. But we'll find that the shift in characterization that I'm interested in is not due to a perception or a perceptual experience, but rather due to testimony and reflection on the testimony by these many women in the room who had made similar experiences to her. So when I say in the title of this paper that sort of Wood came to perceive or see oppression or sexual harassment as oppressive, what I mean is rather more metaphorical way, sense of seeing, and not the kind of seeing that philosophers of perception are interested in. And lastly, in this definition of characterizations, onto the notion of intuitiveness. This is meant to stand generally for something like the characterization people produce is automatic or habitual. And in particular, is meant to say that making a plan to change a characterization can sometimes be quite difficult to implement. So Kamita Wood, thinking about, were she thinking about that she should characterize sexual harassment in a different way, then realizing this plan would typically require processes of training or adaptation and wouldn't be so easy to implement on the fly. Okay, all this stuff on characterizations will now help us to make this idea of the epistemically unhappy experiences and of the epistemic puzzle that I started with more precise. So we can redefine the notion of epistemically unhappy experiences as experiences that entail a characterization which ascribes a bundle of properties to some object, while this object does not actually have at least some of these properties. So in the example of Kamita Wood, the characterization she has, the intuitive interpretation she has of sexual harassment, ascribes properties like personal or self-inflicted to the object sexual harassment, but this object doesn't actually have these properties. We would want to say it's not personal, but it's political. It's not self-inflicted, but it's due to either her boss or perhaps the social structures in which both of them have grown up in and live in now. But this idea of the epistemic puzzle that I'm trying to home in on seems to now turn on the idea that misrepresenting characterizations of this sort are somehow difficult to shed or get rid of. But we haven't quite yet seen why that is. So far we've only seen that plans to change these misrepresenting characterizations are difficult to implement on the fly because these characterizations are automatic and habitual. But this doesn't seem relevant to our case of Kamita Wood. So she has no plan to change her characterizations. She doesn't even, she has no knowledge of sexual harassment as oppressive. She walks into that room with the consciousness raising session because she wants to find help to fill in unemployment benefits, but not because she wants to change what she thinks about sexual harassment. And secondly, so far as we can see now, there are no inhibitions to unplanned changes to our characterizations. So perhaps our characterizations of sexual harassment change all the time, and then it would be no mystery why sometimes they change to the better. Maybe that's just arbitrary. But I don't think it is arbitrary. I think there is an epistemic puzzle here. And to see that, we must add two further ideas to the idea of characterizations. And that is first Elizabeth Camp's or general notion of something like perspective, so a stable perspective onto the world. And secondly, the idea that some characterizations are communally shared and enforced. So this idea of a perspective is again an idea from Elizabeth Camp. And the thought here is that a perspective is just something like an open-ended disposition to characterize. So as a feminist, for example, I might have a relatively stable feminist perspective on the world, which would include particular characterizations of different events, such as sexual harassment, or different characterizations, intuitive interpretations of things like abortion, and so on. And these are stable because, and this is again a thought from Elizabeth Camp, as cognitively limited beings, we somehow require their stability. So if we didn't have a perspective onto the world that produced stable characterizations that are similar from case to case, we would not be able to make sense of, or to quickly make sense and to navigate the world we encounter. So in this way, for the case of Kamita Wood, this means that she not only intuitively produces a misrepresenting characterization in response to a sort of one-off encounter with sexual harassment, but this characterization is likely part of a stable perspective she has onto the world. And as such, it then becomes likely that new encounters with sexual harassment will produce the same or similar characterization as long as Kamita Wood's perspective also remains the same. These perspectives and characterizations are also communally shared and enforced. So this characterization of sexual harassment that Kamita Wood has will be familiar to us because either we have routinely used it at some point, or we've sort of come across it in public culture. So the thought that that sexual harassment is somehow personal or self-inflicted is not just something Kamita Wood invented for herself. And Catherine MacKinnon has a story about why we have these distorting or misrepresenting characterizations, and that story is probably also familiar to many of you. It goes something like this, that social power popularizes those characterizations which the powerful would naturally employ. And so the powerful in this case for Catherine MacKinnon would be men who would know little about the experience of actually being sexually harassed, but the experiences that they would routinely be faced with or encounter might be perhaps being bystanders or even perpetrators of harassment. And then to them, the naturally employed characterization or interpretation would be of sexual harassment as something like a harmless flirtation or a bit of fun. So this characterization, or these sorts of characterizations of sexual harassment, then become communally shared. And women, as Catherine MacKinnon says, are pushed or pressured to see reality in these terms as well. Okay, so now we're finally in a position to get at the epistemic puzzle that I started with. And so the puzzle now is that misrepresenting characterizations will intuitively be produced for encounters with sexual harassment. So this is the idea of a characterization as an intuitive interpretation. And this is because they are part of stable perspectives, which are necessary for us as cognitively limited beings, and they are communally shared and routinely enforced, as we saw with the story from MacKinnon. Okay, and this is a puzzle because Wood fails to produce these characterizations for an encounter with sexual harassment when she finds herself in a room with these other women who've made similar experiences to her. So how can we get out of the endless cycle of routinely invoking misrepresenting characterizations? One common explanation that's central to feminist and Marxist thought is that perhaps this shift is possible only because in these epistemically unhappy experiences, there's somehow within them a seat of truth or a kind of kernel of accuracy. And this is an idea that I think is quite common and assumed in a lot of both feminist and Marxist writings, but I'm going to focus on the more feminist side. So Miranda Fricke, for example, speaks of half-formed understandings that are somehow part of Kamita Wood's or anyone's original experience of oppression. Dorothy Smith, who is a standpoint theorist, speaks of sort of tacit knowledge and things that are known in the doing. Jane Mansbridge from sociology speaks of a gut refusal to be subordinated that is somewhere present, somewhere within every human being. And Sally Haslinger has also picked up on this idea. Or one last representative of this this view is Alison Jagger, who thinks that there might be outlaw emotions in many experiences of oppression. So emotions that don't fit what would be the expected emotion. Say if you hear a racist joke, you're supposed to find it funny, but actually you feel angry about it. So that would be an example of an outlaw emotion. And so these different examples show that for my scheme of, or my way of making sense of this in terms of characterizations, sometimes these seeds of knowledge might be part of the characterization, so that an otherwise misrepresenting characterization has particular properties within it that actually accurately represent the world, or they might be part of the experience but outside the characterization. So that this is the example of an emotion, which, as I said, is not strictly speaking part of how we intuitively characterize the world. Okay, but the thought now for this, for these seeds of knowledge theorists, is that somehow these seeds can grow and can be nurtured. And this might happen either via consciousness raising, so kind of practice of collective knowledge seeking. Sally Haslinger, for example, thinks of it in this way. She thinks that consciousness raising can turn this gut refusal that she takes from Jane Mansbridge into propositional knowledge. Or Dorothy Smith thinks that consciousness raising can unearth tacit knowledge in some way. Seeds may also, the seeds of knowledge may also grow via activism and political struggle. This is an idea that standpoint theorists put forward, such as Sandra Harding, Nancy Hartsock, or they may also grow because of epistemic friction. This is an idea from Medina. So the thought here is that perhaps in the bundle of characterizations, the bundle of properties that is a characterization, we have misrepresenting bits about sexual harassment, but also some accurate bits, and they are somehow in tension with one another, and that then produces or can be productive in beneficial ways and produces an idea about the oppressive nature of an experience. So the problem with this idea of the seeds of knowledge, I think, is not that it's wrong. I think rather it is often portrayed as sort of universal, as the only way in which knowledge about oppression can emerge. And this would have the consequence that if you were someone, or we were living in a society where we didn't have awareness, where we didn't have these seeds of knowledge, where we didn't have awareness of our own pain, frustration, or unhappiness, and where sort of social control would perhaps be so total that there would be no residue of discomfort or no gut refusal left in the experience of oppression, then in such a society, there would be no knowledge of oppression or injustice that was possible to emerge. And this is recognized, so in particular, the Frankfurt School, this type of critical theory, thinks of this as a kind of nightmare, and they hope that this is not how it will be. They are fortunate, they think that we are fortunate, that this is not how our society actually is, that social control isn't this total. There are still these seeds of knowledge left. But I think that it's conceivable that many of us live this nightmare for at least parts of our lives. So as women, perhaps sometimes we actually really enjoy sexual harassment as a flirtation or as a flattery. Perhaps sometimes we really do comply with sexist beauty standards, perhaps sort of happily and eagerly, or perhaps sometimes we unreflectively endorse the domestic division of labor and think of it as somehow suitable or fit to our natural talents in the kitchen. So it seems like this nightmare can sometimes exist. There needn't be seeds of knowledge present in every experience of oppression. And I also think that this might be a nightmare that we can wake up from. And this sort of waking up idea has received a popular name in feminist debate. Sometimes it's called a feminist awakening. So it looks as though what the seeds of knowledge people present as an impossibility isn't so impossible. And this now takes me on to the fourth and last section of my talk, where I'll outline what I think actually enables these shifts in from epistemically unhappy to epistemically happy experiences that Kamita Wood was able to undergo. So I want to suggest that this shift was not enabled by seeds of knowledge that were somehow implanted in her experience, but rather by gaps in the communally shared characterizations. And for this, it makes sense to look back to the precise new situation that Kamita encounters that enables this shift. So here's a quotation again. Kamita Wood comes in and tells her story. We realize that to a person, every one of us, the women on staff, Kamita, the students, had an experience like this before, you know? And none of us had ever told anyone before. It was one of those click aha moments, a profound revelation. As I said earlier, this profound revelation is, I think, about the significance of gender. And this shift, or the aha moment, seems to enable a new understanding of cases like Kamita Wood's as part of a wider pattern of common and unprompted sexual molestations of men by women. And this new understanding of sexual harassment, in my terminology, is a characterization. So it's an intuitive way of sense making that somehow seems to just pop up in the moment. And it seems to click into place, and then Kamita Wood intuitively employs it for the new cases of sexual harassment, so for the testimony she hears from the other women, but probably also to reevaluate her own episodes with her boss. So now, but why does this shift in characterization happen, this sort of click or aha moment? I want to say that it happens because the original characterization is no longer applicable. So there are no seeds of knowledge required, but rather how Kamita Wood originally thought about sexual harassment simply doesn't work anymore. So let's look back to the previous characterization of sexual harassment. There, Wood characterizes her experiences of sexual harassment as first being singled out by her boss due to some fault of her own, perhaps. So she worries that what happened to her is to some extent self-inflicted. She wonders why would anyone single her out? And then she comes up with this intuitive explanation that perhaps this is due to some feature of hers. The second part of her original characterization was this idea that maybe sexual harassment merits shame and embarrassment in some way. But shame and embarrassment are typically apt responses to our own actions, so especially when these actions are wrong or otherwise inappropriate. And the third bit of the characterization was that these experiences are personal rather than social and political. And here the story we can tell seems to be that maybe Wood thinks of these experiences as somehow rare or unusual. And had she been aware that these molestations were common, they would probably be problems of workplace culture or climate with perhaps a social or political dimension. They would not be merely personal and insignificant. So I'm hoping that you can already kind of see where this is going to go. The idea then is that these three characterizations are simply inapplicable in the new situation of sexual harassment. So in this new situation, there is no single property in virtue of which all of the women in the room might have been singled out. This is just a collection of academics, students, staff at Cornell who look very different, who do very different things, who behave very differently. There doesn't seem to be any one feature that all of them share or any group of properties that all of them share that could somehow merit or call for sexual harassment. And similarly, then the second idea that Kamita Wood had intuitively, namely this idea that shame and embarrassment may be apt, or that her experience merits shame or embarrassment, also doesn't seem to make sense anymore. So these emotions, we said, or I said, are apt only as responses to having done something, and perhaps as responses to having done something wrong. But in cases of sexual harassment, it's now revealed that actually something was done to each of these women. There was not anything they did or any property they had. So the second bit also doesn't seem to work. And the third bit also doesn't seem to work, which was the idea that sexual harassment is personal, because now in this new situation, sexual harassment is revealed to be common and even ubiquitous. So it can't just be something personal. So the general idea then is that this old characterization that was misrepresenting sexual harassment simply can't carry over to the new situation because it's no longer applicable. So when many women suffer sexual harassment from a number of different harassers, no one woman is singled out. Shame and embarrassment are not apt emotions for the victim, and the victim's experiences don't seem personal either. There's maybe a kind of caveat or restriction to this general idea, and this is the idea that there are probably no strict limits on the applicability of characterizations. So a characterization may be stretched to apply to a situation which, strictly speaking, it doesn't fit. And this might be a case where someone is insensitive to the evidence. So José Medina discusses the example To Kill a Mockingbird that Miranda Fricker also uses, where basically you have a racist jury and they are convicting an innocent Black person, and they're convicting that Black person not because there is any good evidence, but because of their racist stereotypes. And in fact, there is lots of good evidence for the innocence of Tom Robinson, the Black accused. But the jury is so steeped in their racial attitudes that they simply characterize Tom Robinson as someone who would steal, as a criminal, and they're being inattentive to the evidence. So when I say here that this new characterization of sexual harassment was produced because an old one was no longer applicable, what I mean was that Kamita Wood not only faced a limit in the applicability of her characterization, but intuitively recognized this limit as such in some way. So, and this limit or this inapplicability is what I want to call a hermeneutical gap. So somehow Kamita Wood's established characterization, what is in fact sexual harassment, can't be used to make sense of this collection of the many different cases of sexual harassment that are being recounted. And now Wood has no established, no communally shared, no preformed characterization that was part of her stable perspective to make sense of this new situation. And in this gap, a new characterization can form. So the gap is in some way productive. Now, hermeneutical gaps are probably familiar to Miranda from Miranda Fricker's work, as I suggested at the beginning, where Miranda Fricker thinks of a gap in the collective interpretive resources as an epistemic injustice. So when Kamita Wood was unable to make sense of her experiences, when she thought of them as personal, self-inflicted, perhaps merit and shame and embarrassment and so on, in that case, she was wronged because she didn't have the hermeneutical resource that constituted sexual harassment. And so she was unable to incorporate this concept into her characterization, more accurately characterize sexual harassment, and perhaps learn that she had been harassed, that this was a wrong, that this had to do with gender oppression, and so on. But so the difference between Miranda Fricker's sense of hermeneutical gaps and my sense then is that for Fricker, hermeneutical gaps are epistemic injustices or wrongs, but the gaps that I am speaking about can be opportunities. They can enable an agent to form a new characterization that's ideally a better one and then come to be a knower. Rather than what Fricker thinks as hermeneutical gaps as inhibitions to knowledge. So that's not to say that Miranda Fricker is wrong about hermeneutical injustice or epistemic injustice generally. Rather, I think we differ exactly what we take to be a hermeneutical gap. So Fricker thinks of these gaps as gaps in the accurate or truth-tracking interpretive resources, and these gaps are epistemic injustices. So Kamita Wood was wronged because sexual harassment wasn't there in the interpretive resource, but lots of other misrepresenting resources were actually there. Things like compliment, notation, chasing around the desk behavior, and so on. So when Kamita Wood experienced a hermeneutical injustice, it's not that she didn't have any way of making sense of her experience of sexual harassment. She had lots of ways, they were just misrepresenting. But the hermeneutical gaps that I'm interested in are smaller. They're not gaps in the accurate collective interpretive resources, but they're gaps in the available collective interpretive resources. And this includes both sort of the truth tracking, the accurate resources, but also the misrepresenting resources. So in the case where Kamita Wood encounters this collective consciousness raising situation, she just doesn't have any way of making sense of the new situation. Whereas Fricker wants to say that previously she had lots of ways, they were just all somehow flawed or warped or mistaken. Okay, so we can ask, why is there this smaller gap? Why isn't our world and our resources, why aren't they made in a way that we can actually employ existing hermeneutical resources in all of our situations, no matter whether these are accurate or inaccurate resources. And here again, the story from Catherine MacKinnon that I sketched at the beginning helps us see this. So characterizations, we said, become communally shared because the powerful and privileged would naturally employ them. Then the powerful and privileged are those who are in power. And so they make what they would naturally use to make sense of the world, what everybody uses to make sense of the world. But the situation where women come together and share their experiences of sexual harassment is not a situation that the powerful and privileged would typically encounter. That's the main thought. So they therefore didn't have an opportunity to employ a characterization for this experience and to make this characterization communally shared. So then if one were to look for opportunities to learn about injustice, look for ways in which one opportunities to shift one's intuitive characterizations, like Kamita Wood was able to do, then situations which the powerful and privileged are unlikely to encounter might be a good place to start searching for these hermeneutical gaps. And this is something that feminists and in particular sort of people who have done consciousness raising for feminist activist groups have actually done. They've sort of sought out experiences or situations where that for which we might not have these communally shared characterizations. So the general thought of my talk then is that a hermeneutical gap, as I've sketched it, is an opportunity for epistemic improvement, but it should be said that these opportunities can be wasted. So it might be that Wood has this gap in her characterizations and produces a new characterization in it, but this new characterization is just as misrepresenting or as distorted as the old one. So perhaps she doesn't think of sexual harassment as personal anymore. Perhaps now she thinks of sexual harassment as something that one deserves qua being a woman, for example. So that would also be a characterization that would make sense of the new situation, where that would be applicable to the facts of the new situation. Another way in which opportunities for epistemic improvement like this might be wasted is if Kamita Wood develops an accurate characterization but has false beliefs about sexual harassment that still override it. And a third way in which it might also be wasted is perhaps Wood develops an accurate characterization, has appropriate beliefs, but when she encounters yet another episode of sexual harassment, then she will go back to her old misrepresenting characterizations. So that's all to say that these opportunities that I've been trying to emphasize are not guarantees for better characterizations or for developing knowledge. So then to conclude, Catherine MacKinnon says that feminism emerges from women's particular experiences. And one way in which we might make this quotation more precise is to say that perhaps feminism emerges from one aspect of women's experiences. So this is what the seeds of knowledge people would say. And this is the aspect or the sort of seed, the part of the experience that in some way accurately registers oppression. But I've suggested that there's a different way of making MacKinnon's statement more precise, which is that feminism also can emerge from a particular kind of experience, namely from an encounter with a hermeneutical gap in the communally shared characterizations. Thanks.
Thanks to Paula. And now we will take an 8-minute break. We're going to start exactly 5 p.m. Because we have a let's discuss the model a little bit, and as importantly,